This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. If I ask you to picture a wolf, the image that most likely comes to mind is the gray wolf. That's the large, menacing animal of fairy tales and movies. But here in North Carolina, there is a very different kind of wolf. It's called the red wolf, and for a time, it was almost extinct. Then an unprecedented preservation project intervened to restore the wolf's population. Asheville-based nature and science writer Delene Beelan joins us now from WCQS in Asheville to talk about her latest book, The Secret World of Red Wolves, The Fight to Save North America's Other Wolf. Welcome, Delene. Good to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about this red wolf and what distinguishes it from the gray wolf.
Right. That's a good starting place because a lot of people look at the red wolf in comparison to the gray wolf, as you did in the introduction, because that's the wolf that we know much more about in the popular media and public. So red wolves are intermediate between gray wolves and coyotes. If you were to line up on a table a skull of a coyote, a red wolf, and a gray wolf, it would literally look like small, medium, and large. So coyotes tend to be in weight about 15 to 40 pounds, just loosely, very loosely speaking, whereas a gray wolf is going to be 70 pounds to 100 pounds or more. Now, a red wolf kind of fits snugly in between. They're going to be, the females are going to be about 45 to 65 pounds, and the males are going to be about 55 to 85 pounds. So it's kind of a caricature, but if you think of small, medium, and large, that's a good way to picture it.
Okay, so that's good. That gives us a little size distinction. I'm guessing it's reddish in color.
It is reddish, as red as you would think. One of my favorite quotes when I was interviewing advocates, Red Wolf advocates, was a woman who said that she had expected red wolves to have I Love Lucy red hair, and they really don't. It's kind of more of a burnt umber or a cinnamon red. I call it a forest red in the book. You know, it's kind of the red that you might expect when you see dried pine straw lit by a summer sunset.
Which
it's not
would
bright.
Which would help them camouflage somewhat
exactly,
in the pine
for a southeastern
straw
forest.
Of the
yes.
southeastern forest. So tell us about their habitat and their history here in the Carolinas.
Yeah, this could be a complicated question, but I'll try to make it simple. We think that red wolves lived throughout the southeast and that they were present at the time of European settlement. And their range would have been pretty much from central Texas, possibly up into southern Illinois, south of the Great Lakes, and then east towards the ocean. So if you think from the mid-Atlantic south, back down to Florida, that's kind of what their range probably was. So we tend to call it a southeastern wolf, southeastern forest wolf. That would be the historic range.
All right. So that's their range. We think they've been here for a couple hundred years at least. Certainly when European settlers got here, they may have found them. What happened to them?
Well, and I should add, they were probably here much longer than that. Yeah. There's scant fossil evidence, but there is fossil evidence that they were here several thousands of years ago. But as with anything in science where there's scant evidence, that becomes controversial as to what it really is. I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Well, I just want to know what happened to them, because we understand that they went very, very nearly went extinct.
Right. So at the time that Europeans first began settling, wolves were pretty much persecuted from that point forward. So it was kind of an ad hoc persecution. And I say ad hoc because later there was a federal extermination campaign to get rid of gray wolves. And it wasn't a concerted effort like that. It was more settlers, colonists, trying to protect their homesteads, protect their livestock. And in some cases, I think it was also sort of a pathological hatred of wolves. It was just the culture of the time to despise wolves. They were called the devil's dogs. They were seen as a symbol of the devil. And so if you throw some religious connotations in there, it was simply an animal that wasn't well liked at all. So there was even bounties, financial incentives for settlers to kill wolves. People dug pit traps and trapped them that way. They shot them in some colonies in the Northeast, in New England. There was even requirements that settlers have wolfhounds and kill them that way. So there were many different ways that they were persecuted, but they were basically hunted to almost near extinction.
And when did that happen? I mean, how long did it take before they finally got to that point?
So by the 1900s, early 1900s, they were extremely rare throughout the southeast, and they were more heavily populated in what I'll call the southwestern part of their range, in Texas, eastern Texas, the Ozarks, and western Louisiana. So it didn't take very long at all. It's less than 200 years it probably took to really put enough pressure on them to make them very rare.
Now, when did anybody start getting concerned about their population and make an effort to restore them?
In the second half of the 1900s, it was first noticed that they were in trouble, I would say, in the 1950s and 60s, but that was only by very few people. And there was one biologist in particular, Howard McCarley, from Texas, who first noticed that the wild canids that he remembered and that, you know, from his youth in the landscape were becoming much smaller. And so he started studying them and realizing that what he was seeing were coyotes that were coming in from the west, and that the wolves that he remembered from his childhood were very few. And so he was the first one to write a paper, I think it was in the late 60s, that documented, maybe it was the early 60s, that documented that red wolves were in trouble and needed some help. And from there, people got interested. The Fish and Wildlife Service got involved. And by the 70s, they were listed, 1973, they were in the first batch of species listed on the Endangered Species Act.
And that's interesting, because the fact that they've been nearly extinct for a long time gives us a way, at least, to try to measure the ecological impact. Do we know what happened? What animals filled their niche, and what other kinds of results, else resulted from their absence or near absence?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's been so much in the media lately about trophic cascades because of the effect of gray wolves in the Northwest, or excuse me, the Northern Rocky Mountains. In terms of their effect, we know that coyotes reinvaded the East when the red wolf was pushed out of it. So that basically created a predatory vacuum. You know, there was room in the landscape for a top predator, and there was no top predator left. You know, eastern cougars had been killed off. Red wolves had been killed off. There were still bears, but bears are more omnivorous. They're not quite that apex predator. And so coyotes started coming back, and that's what we're seeing now, is the reinvasion of coyotes to the east.
And what is an apex predator?
Oh, I'm sorry, a top predator in the ecosystem. An apex predator kind of sits at the top of the food chain.
Which suggests that there weren't gray wolves in this area, or that they're not at the top of the chain. Were there many gray wolves
right.
in the southeast?
That's a good question, and that's debated. I don't personally believe that there were gray wolves. There's no reliable records of gray wolves in the east. Some biologists will tell you that there probably was a small southeastern gray wolf, but that's something I discuss in the book, but it's definitely controversial.
Well, so now talk about the preservation efforts. What happened once people decided to take this seriously?
So there was an effort in southeastern Texas and southwestern Louisiana to round up what was thought to be the last wild red wolves. And at the time, they wanted to, the Fish and Wildlife Service wanted to preserve the red wolf in its natural habitat. They wanted to keep the wolves, you know, on the landscape. But the man who was put in charge of the field station to study these wolves realized that coyotes had invaded that area too, and they were actively hybridizing with red wolves. And he realized that the red wolf was in much, much deeper trouble than anybody had realized, because they thought that area was free of coyotes. And so he kind of spearheaded and pushed a movement to captive breed them. The Point Defiance Zoo and Aquarium in Tacoma, Washington, got involved. They happened to have land and facilities to help with captive breeding. And so the last, what's thought to be the last wild red wolves were captured from that area and shipped off to Point Defiance Zoo and Aquarium, where a captive breeding program was started. And the founders from that program, there were let's just say this. There were hundreds of wild canids that were trapped and captured down in Texas and Louisiana. Of those, only about 17 were found to be true red wolves, and of those, only 14 bred.
Wow.
So there were, I believe, around 450 wild canids that were trapped, and of those, only 14 became breeders in the Red Wolf Recovery Program. So that just shows you kind of the dire situation of what was going on with them in the wild. And they were very lucky. They bred easily in captivity. It didn't take much to figure that out. And within a few generations, they had enough to reintroduce some in North Carolina. The big problem there was just finding the land to do so, and that took a little bit of time. But in 1987, they released the first pairs of red wolves to Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge. And now the recovery program takes up about 1.7 million acres in the Albemarle Peninsula in a five-county area.
And about how many wolves do we guess are populating that part of the world now?
There's about 100. Yeah, there's about 100. The numbers fluctuate throughout the year. There's deaths every year, and then puppies are born and that sort of thing. So the Fish and Wildlife Service just put out a press release a few days ago saying that there were 34 puppies born this spring. Usually they have more. It's usually more 40, 50, 60 range. So it's a little concerning that there's that few. But still, it's good to know that they are, you know, reproducing in the wild. That's the goal.
And is there a threat? It sounds like they're in protected areas now, but if they come out of those areas, we're going to have the same problem all over again, right? Because people don't like them hanging around their backyard.
Yeah, it's interesting. With the Gray Wolf Recovery Program out west, we're used to hearing about Yellowstone National Park being a core refuge for the wolves. And with the Red Wolf Recovery Program, it's actually more private lands than public lands that's being used. And this is something that's very unique to this program, especially for a large carnivore, a large predator like a wolf. So there's about 60% is privately held. 40% is either national wildlife refuges, state game lands, or lands that are in some sort of conservation program. And so that's an unusual scenario. So what the Fish and Wildlife Service has done, the recovery program has done, is work very closely on an individual basis with private landowners. And they value those relationships quite a lot because the landowners give them access to their lands, their farms, and their woods to track the red wolves, to look in on the dens and document the puppies and that sort of thing. So it's an interesting situation. But with that said, there are definitely people who don't like red wolves, and there is social intolerance within the recovery area. One of the things I talk about in the book, I have a whole chapter dealing with people in the Albemarle Peninsula and their attitudes towards the red wolf. And one of the things I found was that because the program has been going on for so long, for 2.5 decades, some of the initial anger and resentment towards the wolves has sort of settled out over time. That's not to say that it's gone away, but it has. I think that the sharpness of the anger, that the edges of it have faded away a bit.
You know, a minute ago you talked about the hybridization with mm-hmm. coyotes. I mean, the fact is they can interbreed.
Yes.
And that was happening. So isn't that a survival strategy? I mean, to some degree, when you talk about interbreeding, I assume that they breed fertile animals so that they can go
yes.
on. And what's that hybrid like? And is that, I mean, how does that pose? Isn't that what nature's saying, okay, here's how we're going to do this now?
Yes,
we don't
that's
need
a great
you.
Question. That's a wonderful question. And it's a complicated question. It gets into evolutionary processes. But one thing to keep in mind with the hybridization is that we're talking about, with the coyote population, we're talking about a continent's worth of coyotes. With the red wolf population, we're talking about a very small population that takes up a five-county area that's only 100 individuals. And so when you think about the scale, it's easy to see how the red wolf population could just become swamped by coyote hybridization. Now, in the past, if you think about what their historic population probably was at some point in the southeast, it's easier to conceive that perhaps hybridization took place along the edges of that population where they met, but not enough to swamp the red wolf. And so that's one scenario that we think, you know, how it might have been historically. Today, the hybridization issues, the Red Wolf Recovery Program has come up with some very unique management strategies to prevent hybridization. And they have had, I think, just one documented hybridization event where the offspring of a coyote red wolf pair made its way back into the red wolf population, bringing coyote genes with them. So given that red wolves and coyotes are living side by side on the peninsula and have been for more than a decade, that's pretty amazing that they've managed to prevent that hybridization, you know, to that degree. But then the question that you raised about, is this a natural thing? That's another really good question. Some people believe that, some researchers that I spoke with said, maybe we should just let the red wolf breed with coyotes and let things settle out. Now, if we were to do that, this is completely, by the way, a question of values. If we were to do that, we'd be saying goodbye to the red wolf as we know it today. It would go extinct. Its genes would live on within that hybrid population, but the animal itself we would be letting it go. And that's not something that personally I can stomach with all the research that I've put into learning about this animal. I think there's still quite a lot we have to learn about them. So I do support the management techniques that they're doing right now to prevent the hybridization.
Well, tell us what got you interested in this in the first place.
So I did. It was kind of a convoluted path. I did my master's research on the Mexican gray wolf reintroduction project in the American Southwest. It's taking place in Arizona and New Mexico. And in the literature review for that project, I kept running into papers talking about red wolves, and I had no clue what a red wolf was. And I thought that was very odd that, you know, here I was, someone who loved wildlife, loved nature, and had grown up completely ignorant of the fact that there was a wolf in the Southeast. So I was just very intrigued by this idea, and I saved some of those papers. And later, after I graduated, I moved to North Carolina and just happened to move about 4 hours inland from the Red Wolf Recovery Program. And I thought, this is my moment. I need to learn more about this. And I started looking for things to read, aside from the scientific literature that I had already come across. And I just couldn't find a recent book that was comprehensive, that had the depth that I was looking for. And that was when I realized I would probably need to write the book that I wanted to read, the book that I couldn't find.
Well, you did. And thank you for sharing its contents with us. Deline, so nice to talk with you.
Thank you. You too.
Deline Beeland is a nature and science writer based in Asheville, North Carolina. Her latest book is called The Secret World of Red Wolves, The Fight to Save North America's Other Wolf. And for more information about her and the book, go to our website, wunc.org. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening. A program directed by Alex Granados, produced by Isaac Davey Aronson, Sean Wen and Nicole Campbell. Adija Manley and Mark Haywood are the interns. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolf, our news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.